Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Right now, get a free select tool when you buy the Craftsman V20 2-Pack Battery Kit. Whether it's the backyard, the bathroom, or beyond, Craftsman has the tools to help you power through and get the project done right. Because DIYing is unpredictable, but your tools shouldn't be. Shop Craftsman at Lowe's today. Valid through 7-9 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. Maximum initial battery voltage measured without a workload is 20 volts. Nominal voltage is 18.
Hey everybody, it's Nicole Byer here with some hot takes from Wayfair. A cozy corduroy sectional from Wayfair? Yeah, that's a hot take. Go on and add it to your cart and take it. A pink glam nightstand from Wayfair? Scalding hot take. Take it before I do. A mid-century modern cabinet from Wayfair that doubles as a wine bar? Do I have to say it? It's a hot take. Get it at Wayfair.com and enjoy that free shipping too.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Hi guys, welcome back to Textory. If you don't know what Textory is, shame on you. It's a podcast about history, basically. We read historical texts and we dissect them and we laugh at them and we always relate to them in a way which is both encouraging and a little bit sad sometimes. Before we get into that, though, do check out my Patreon at patreon.com/textory to support me. And if you want more episodes to come, please do it anyway. Today, we're doing a mirror episode to an episode you might have heard if you have followed Textory for a while. A while ago, we did an episode called A Woman You Should Not Marry. And at the end of the episode, I did hint that it was not the last thing we heard from the book's author. So today we are doing, you guessed it, A Man You Should Not Marry. So to keep things balanced, we're all about equality here. Today we're gonna dive into that. So a little bit of context first, in case you are not familiar with the previous book. So basically, the guy's name is Reinhold Gerling. He was a German scientist, I guess, or like basically a writer. I don't know if he actually had any formal education in that matter, because he used to be an actor, apparently. But at the time of writing the book comes out in 1922. He first writes the book, Women You Should Never Marry. And in the book, he does mention that, woohoo, this book's a little controversial. It's probably going to lose me a little bit of my female fans. And he was probably damn right, because the book is a massive diss on like all types of women. So like, if you listen to the last episode, you will know. But by the end of the book, you're basically like, no women are ever fit to marry, because that's what you're gathering from what he wrote. But basically, at the time of writing the book, he was a 60-year-old man. Now, I'm not trying to be ageist here, but I do think in terms of his views, it does make a difference, because at the time, obviously, similarly to today, the younger you were, probably the more open you were to new ideas. But I think it's also interesting that he didn't quite subscribe to the conventional medicine, to conventional science, and I think it 100% shows in what he's writing. And what's even more interesting is that he was apparently involved with like the very early LGBT movement. He literally had lectures on homosexuality as early as 1902. Which is pretty unheard of. Apparently, those were really popular lectures and people would come over, listen to the lectures, and it would also sometimes make them come out, apparently, which is insane to think that that happened in 1902. And his son told a story that we don't actually know if it's true, but apparently his dad, so the writer, used to have a friend who was gay. And his friend was so afraid of persecution that he carried a tiny capsule of arsenic in case he got outed, so he could bite into the capsule and basically die, just like poison himself. So that shook him to the core. And I'm not actually sure if his friend passed away and that caused him to get interested in the subject, or if it was just the idea of him carrying that capsule around. But that apparently prompted him to become more interested in the topic. However, that's not at all what we're talking about today. I just thought it's interesting. Today, we're focusing on the man that you should never marry, because Reinhold wrote the first book and he probably was like, okay, I'm not actually sexist. I'm going to keep it equal. So we're going to also write a book on men and we'll see how you like that, huh? To be fair, though, I do think it's completely different than the first one. So even though he was trying to keep it unbiased, I do think his views are showing very clearly on the matter in the book. So again, the book that I found was actually in Polish. It was originally in German, and then I translated it from Polish to English. So it might be not 100% accurate in terms of the translation because I am not a translator, but I did my best. Do with that what you will. So it's 1922. You're a Polish woman. You just read a book on women you should not marry, or you saw your brother read a book like that and you were like extremely offended. You were like, what are you reading? And then he was like, go check it out. And you borrowed it from your brother and you were like, what the hell? And then you saw that the guy published another book on men that you should not marry. And you were like, huh, let's see what that one's about. And you took the book and you were probably thinking that you're gonna get some solid advice. And this is what you got. The following brochure was created due to my other work, A Woman You Should Never Marry, after which I received letters from the female circles, both full of appreciation and fiery protests, all of which could be summed up with a call, "Won't you now tell us women what kind of a man one shouldn't marry?" Some have complained that the title Woman You Should Never Marry is sensationalist, and I am certain this essay will provoke a similar response. The poorest of the poor, the blindest of the blind, the woman. When faced with the mass dying in Europe, she raised the curtain of habit and indifference. The woman's powers, crippled for ages, are finally freed. The cruelty of the biggest war that the earth has ever witnessed have shook the woman and enticed her to plot to get ladies apart from basic human dignity, human rights that they deserve. Okay, so he's starting off with a feminist manifesto because he knows they were angry after the last one, but he doesn't really follow up on that claim. Like, the rest of the book is not in the similar tone. The pressing question remains, where are the husbands to marry? Or does the government think women should be happy to go to a convent? No, they want to get to live their female destiny, get married and have children. But what are they to do when there is no man? This was genuinely a problem after the First World War because so many young men died that the already messed up proportion of women being basically lonely because there were not enough men for them to marry, it got even worse after the war. The case is desperate. We all have daughters, aunts, cousins that wish for spouses and children. We are facing losing great numbers of young mothers who, reaching the age of 20, need to lead solitary and infertile lives. What are we to do? Can we stop this horror from happening? It is not my task to consider the purpose and feasibility of such ideas. After all, the women of 20th century get married for different reasons than just procreating. I love every time I read an old text, and they're like, after all, we're 20th century women. Or I think that was in one of the podcast episodes, actually, like the one with the Polish diary, where the lady was like, is that what 19th century friendships look like? Because to them, obviously, it sounded 100% modern and 100% contemporary. But to us, it's like, it just sounds really anachronistic. They value quality over quantity, and the times of the girl getting married off, or rather sold, by her parents to the highest bidder are long gone. They value quality over quantity. I think that's really interesting. Apparently, according to him, prior to the 20th century, you would just get married because that was the thing to do, and you would not really worry about who that was, but rather just the idea of getting married in the first place. But apparently, times have changed. And now girls were just not that willing to marry anyone. They were a little more picky, and the parents were not as much involved as they were before as well. The girls of the nearest future may have less to choose from, but on the other hand, more possibilities to meet and vet the men properly. That's actually also a good point, because the society has changed and the 20s were socially a lot more integrated, let's say, than what happened before the war. So you would not need to be like properly introduced. You would not need to stick to the etiquette. It was way less formal to meet a man, and you could go out with him. You could be seen in public with a man. I mean, there were probably still circles where that was unheard of or just considered improper. But in general, the male-female heterosexual relationships got much more chill. Don't quote me on that. But there was just a lot less pressure. You could just be out there and mingle with men, and you would not be considered a broken, shameful woman. I wholeheartedly agree with the American writer Beatrice Fairfax, who, after years-long experience and meticulous studying of different marriages, speaks to her sisters. Do not take this most important step of your lives with your eyes blinded by love. It does not matter if the man is handsome. What you must ensure is that he is a good man. Preach, Beatrice. I agree. But also, I think she can be referring to the fact that before the war, engagements were very quick and marriages were very quick. Everything that happened, it could have taken weeks and not years and not even months. So she is also like, slow down. This is important. Divorces are still rare. So it's an important step, and just make sure that you actually want this. There is nothing sadder in the world than to see an ill-matched couple walking the earth together. He could be a great husband if he married a woman who could understand him and raise his soul. She could be a great woman with a husband who could awake the beautiful traits of her nature. Both of them separately could have been something, but they're a pitiful mismatched creation. Household tragedies like this are usually the consequence of too little time spent together before marriage. Wow, that's a little harsh. Both of them separately could have been something, but together they're literally nothing. They don't contribute to society in any way, and they actually don't contribute to each other's lives in any way either. I would probably not want to be described like that if I was in a marriage that didn't quite work, but Beatrice Fairfax did not care at all. So these were her views that he's quoting, and now it's back to his views. These American views seem very reasonable to me, apart from the last sentence that I can only half agree with. The last sentence was, household tragedies like this are usually the consequence of too little time spent together before marriage. But he argues, these troubles arise not from the short acquaintance, but from the misunderstanding of the character and the duties of married life. Okay, I mean, I told you he's old. And I do think it shows in things like this, where he's like, no, you don't actually need to know your partner. Just know what marriage is like before you marry. But it's like easier said than done. Obviously, in the 1920s, you did not have the means and the tools to check what married life is like before you marry. So how would you know? How would you know? Only children. So he's again picking that argument up. He's already said that about women. Only children are not great marriage candidates. They are either raised overly strict or overly indulging. Either way, they are an offspring of weakened parents or a dying family. So dying family, I did not quite know how to translate that, but what he meant was a family that's dying off. So there is like less and less relatives, people don't have children. And he argues that if you only have one child, that means something's wrong. That means that the family's shrinking and you're not fit to have more children. But again, he argues that an only child, someone that has no siblings, is bad for a marriage because they will be selfish, which I think even nowadays is quite a popular myth about people that didn't have siblings. And I have to say, I mean, when I was at school, let's say like first grade, I do remember that only children were a mess to play with because they would just not share. But that usually went away within like the first 2 years of school, because obviously they were in touch with other people and they just had to learn it their own way. That yes, you have to share. Yes, it's good to help other people. They basically had to learn kindness because they didn't have to do that before. I wonder if someone that was raised in, let's say, a rich family in the 1910s, 1920s, if they perhaps did not have that possibility because they just did not see other children throughout their adolescent life. I don't know. But then I'm thinking, you know, it's not like they were completely isolated. And even people that were completely isolated grow up to be, you know, compassionate people. So I still think it's a myth. But it's interesting that he considered it so important that he featured it in both of his books. The age of a man entering marriage is also important. A man is mature and strong enough to give healthy children only after finishing to grow. If his body is still in need of strength and vitality to develop, he doesn't have enough of it to ensure his baby to be healthy. Therefore, the women of our climate should not enter marriage before they're 20 and men before they're 25. This is an unusual view for 1922. Yes, they would probably agree that teenagers are not fit to marry yet, but being 20 and 25 does seem within the spectrum of ages that people married back then. So I do find it interesting that he's like, you should actually be older than 25. Which was still probably the norm, because I'm actually always surprised at how high the average age that people entered marriage was in different eras. It's usually way higher than you think. And I know it's average, which means a lot of people went below that. But still, in late 19th century in the UK, if I remember correctly, it was like 27 years for a woman. So yes, a lot of women were younger than that, but also a lot of women were older than that for that to be the average. And it's always until I see a story of someone who's like, oh, I'm 19 and I've been divorced for 2 years, that I'm like, oh, it was socially acceptable back then. It was not similar to today, because today people would consider it highly unusual. The husband should be older than the wife, but a part of the same generation. Again, a very interesting view considering that age gaps were very common at the time, especially after the First War and then after the Second. As I said, young men were rare. Not rare, but a lot of them died, and you did not have the ability to pick and choose and be like, but you're like 10 years older than me. No, you just dealt with that the best you could. But he still considers it best to be of the same generation. So he does not approve of marriages where the man could basically be the father and vice versa. I'd like to share my thoughts on marrying a genius man. Again, it's sort of a mirror argument to when he said that wives that are artists are not going to be good wives. Of course, you don't meet them in dozens, but the great artists and scholars also make up the marriage market. The artistic couples are rarely, maybe never, happy. A genius may be truly in love and marry for love, wishing to make his beloved happy, but in the end, he will turn to his only passion, a passion that completely takes over his life. So his theory is that if you're an artist, you will always put art first, which is like a valid claim, not really claim, but it is a valid fear when you're seeing someone that is very consumed by their work. But I don't think it only applies to artists and geniuses. Like, I think anyone that is a workaholic or that puts work above their relationships is going to have a problem with that, unless they find like a compromise. But he also thinks that because someone puts so much effort and energy into their art that they're not going to have enough energy to have children. After all, creating and procreating is the same thing. And to be creative both physically and mentally is not possible. I think he said something similar about women. He mentioned that women that are consumed by their art are just not going to have enough energy for love. I think that's what he was saying. I would also warn against a relationship with a man who's chasing skirts. As an old German saying goes, a man is a creature of habit. And it is quite untrue that the most frivolous of men can become good husbands. That's a point that I don't remember him making in the female book, which is interesting because it's usually the case that we accuse women of being too loose, let's say, and pursuing multiple men at once. But here we have a case of a man who's chasing skirts and that he's not a good husband material. And back then, I think it was genuinely the case. If someone already broke so many societal norms, he probably did not care much about sustaining the one norm, which is like getting married. So I think if someone was serious about marriage back then, it made sense that a man that keeps having a lot of partners, he is maybe not the most loyal, will not suddenly change and be like, you know what, I want to get married. I know it happens, but ladies, keep scrolling. This is not about you. Do not marry a man that brags about his many conquests, as his cynicism will over time become an offense. Do not marry a man that has broken his promise to a seduced woman. Since if he was insincere in one aspect of life, he might as well be insincere in marriage. Fair. I mean, again, back then it wasn't just a case of a man hooking up with someone. It was a case of a man taking a woman's reputation and tearing it apart with his behavior. So if he promised a broken, let's say broken woman something, like he was like, oh, I'm going to marry you, don't worry. And then he didn't. Then 100% that's not husband material. A man ideal exists only in the minds of the romance reading youngsters. He's coming after booktok girlies that are yet unaware that people, like old coins, wear over time. And yet the ideal remains in the adult mind, and when a suitor appears, he is compared to it or made one. So he's basically, in her head, he's being made the ideal, even though he's actually not ticking off the boxes. That is why not many girls see and love the man for who he really is, but rather as their own fantasy and an answer to a dire longing. I mean, this is a good point in any era. Just don't fall in love with the image of a man instead of a man. I think that's pretty fair. But as you may have noticed, so far it's mostly about a man's character or like types of men that you should avoid, but nothing about his physicality. And the female version of this book was full of things that a woman looks like that you should avoid. But fear not, he was trying to keep it equal, so he did mention some physical traits. But I still think compared to the female book, this one is much more mild in the way he picks a man's appearance apart. I do think that he was much more ruthless in what he was doing with the female appearance, which makes sense because at the end of the day, he was a man. Let's have a look at the male physical traits. An impressive posture. If a big height is not topped off by a small head of ill proportions, there isn't much to pick on here. So he thought that impressive posture is a good sign, but he also said something very interesting about men's height. Smart women give priority to average height and do not discriminate short men while rejecting giants. And there is a reason for that. It is often that the attic of those who by nature were equipped with many floors is empty. Unusually tall men almost always have empty heads. I can bet my ass he was a short guy. I actually don't know, but this is such a read. He's like, girlies, don't go for the tall men. They're actually dumb. They're actually stupid. They do not think. But it's interesting that he's like, you should not actually discriminate short men. it is not a sign of illness. It is completely healthy. Because when it came to women's appearance, he was like, this is bad, this is bad, this is a bad sign. And then here he's like, no, actually, this is not bad. And the same thing happens when he talks about blondes and brunettes in terms of like male appearance. I very often hear questions regarding blondes versus brunettes. A well-known current in anthropology sets the blonde race higher than the other. I think this is a subtle nod to the, let's say, Weimar Republic eugenics, because what does he mean when he says a well-known current in anthropology? I think he's referring to the idea that Aryan race is somehow superior, which may have already existed in the 1920s. I'm actually not sure. Let me check. Yep, it was already a thing in the late 19th century. So he definitely is referring to that. But what he's saying is, a well-known current in anthropology sets the blonde race higher than the other and considers blondes the heroes of humanity. Even though I would like to give blondes precedence, I can't support the theory of their superiority completely. It is undeniable that brunettes also have their charms and are generally more liked. Fun fact, the man himself, it's difficult to say what he looked like, but I think he had dark hair, so he's a little biased in here, but he also has a whole theory about facial hair. On a face too wide, a beard is definitely becoming. Sideburns, on the other hand, are very complimenting for a narrow face. It is impossible to deny that a beard or a mustache can be a natural complement. They grow on a face, therefore they belong there. To artificially get rid of it shows, unless it is a caprice of fashion, a tendency for hiding. Guess what? The guy also had a mustache. This is what I meant when I said that he does seem much more positive in his description of ideal man, because he's like, facial hair is actually nice. Short guys are okay. Blondes and brunettes are both good for marriage. Whereas with the female book, he was like, this type of hair is awful. This is a bad sign. This means she's not going to have children. It was much more fear-mongering with the female book. Naturally, facial hair must be kept neat. Then it can serve as a testimony of a person's ability to maintain their body. Facial hair can be an adornment if it doesn't completely cover the lower half of the face and doesn't fall too wide on the cheeks. But he does have some criticisms to share. And this is what he says. A blank stare and boring features, together with an inconsequential profile and a disappearing chin, that's a picture of a person without energy. Boy, oh boy, that's literally me. Small, flat male noses are always a sign of persons lacking in the mental department. Rough and wide noses show materialism and sensuality, while a hooked or a monkey-like nose shows an internal disharmony and bad traits. Very hooked nose, when paired with mean features, shows arrogance and a tendency for arguments. The more noble the nose, the more noble the character. So he basically describes every nose type, and every type of a nose is bad and shows a bad trait, basically. Vain people with a busy mind have small eyes. So he does pick male appearance apart as well, but I still feel it's nowhere near intense as it was with the female appearance. Interestingly, he does pay attention to hands a lot. So he mentions like different types of hands. And then he says, for a scientist, even certain hand movements are important. For example, how a person holds a cane, an umbrella, a cigar. He even attaches a drawing of people holding cigars. And there is like positions of the cigar that he considers a bad sign. So he's still definitely obsessed with like how the appearance affects the character and vice versa. But at the same time, it does seem like he is also a lot more forgiving than when it came to women. And what about jealousy? I would advise against marrying a man who poisons the engagement with unexplained jealousy. There is nothing worse for a loving wife than living with a sickly, jealous, untrusting husband. Jealousy is not a product of love. It is not a proof for strength and one's self-confidence. It is a sign of sick psyche. Again, he's kind of fighting the stereotype of a jealous wife and a man that just wants to live his life and the wife keeps bothering him. So good for him for that. And then he goes with his usual, if you have any sort of problem with yourself, you should not marry because there is too many people that are looking for a partner and you are only intruding. You're just keeping them away from finding love because you exist, which in itself is obviously very ableist. And we already know that from the previous book, because in the previous one, he was also like, if you're in any way ill or disabled, you should not have children. And this is kind of what he says. The men that are sickly and not suited for marriage should, just like women, stay away from that institution because they will not be able to fulfill its destiny. In his view, the primary and only function of a marriage is to have children. So if you can't have children, might as well stay lonely forever. That's his view. Marriage is a will of two to create one. And that one means more than the two that have created it. Okay, Shakespeare? A mutual reverence for those capable of such will, I call marriage. Build up above yourself and let the marriage garden help you with that. And that's the ending of this wonderful brochure. I have to say, his views are kind of weird because they are not typical for the era. They're not typical for the conservatives of the era, but they're not very progressive either. Some of them are low-key modern. Some of them I agree with. And then he always says something that I'm like, what do you even mean? Like, the way someone holds an umbrella tells me about their character. I mean, maybe sometimes, but it is more than likely that I won't know someone's true character until I actually meet them. And as Beatrice Fairfax, which he quoted, said, it is often like the lack of knowledge that haunts marriages, or too little time spent together before marriage. And that's basically something that he disagrees with. He thinks that you can look at a person's hands and the way they hold a cigar and you'll know everything about the guy that you need to know. So obviously, I don't think that's the modern standard of viewing relationships and psychology. But at the same time, it's not as tragic as I thought it would be. And as I said many times in this episode, much milder than what he said about women. Don't forget to check out my Patreon at patreon.com/textree. And I'll hear you in another episode. Bye.